Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Just a little moment before I do the talk. Some people have noticed it's a bit hazy today, and it's probably smoke from a huge fire that has erupted in Northern California, right over the border, called the McKinney Fire. I'm distracted today because that fire is a couple of miles from my hometown, and my sister and family have had to evacuate, so I'm a little distracted, but I'll get back on it. But wish them well. Wish the firefighters well. So this talk is about what we call archetypes. An archetype is a model, a role model, or an ideal example of something. And here, obviously, we have a shared archetype of the Buddha. But we inhabit archetypes, which you might think of as stereotyped roles, all the time. Sometimes they're projected onto us by other people, and sometimes we just volunteer for them. And I'll talk a little bit more about how that happens. Archetypal roles can have a shadow side, and I think we tend to think of them as being unfortunate, but there's also really positive aspects to seeing them and working with them. So that's what I'm talking about today. Now, by the archetypes we inhabit, I'm thinking about the parent and the child, the teacher and the student, the healer and the patient, and the big one big one is the hero and the villain. Right? And I present these as pairs because we don't enter into a stereotyped role when we're all alone. We enter into a stereotyped role in response to a relationship. They arise in relationship. And if another person repeatedly approaches us, say in a child role, and repeatedly responds to whatever we do as though we are a parent, it can be very difficult not to respond as a parent. It can be very difficult not to fall into these pairs. Now, these are very old, and the Buddha used these as teaching roles all the time. Ancient India, we think we're stuck in social roles. Ancient India was so deeply constrained by social roles, and most people had no choice about what role they would inhabit throughout their entire life. And Buddhism was a radical response to that social system because people rejected the roles. They stepped outside of any common social role. And yet, most of the time, he's speaking to the vast majority of people who don't have a choice. So he often talked about parents and children and caregivers. In the Anguttara Nikaya Sutta, he talks about caregivers and patients. What are the good qualities? What are the negative qualities? He talked about wives and husbands, wise people and foolish people, often as pairs. And the Dhammapada is filled with these pairings, these a wise person, a foolish person, etc. So we've inherited this way of talking about ourselves. But I started this practice when I was fairly young. I think I was 22, quite young. And I didn't believe for a second that my behavior was in any way driven by such a thing as an archetype. Of course, that's part of the archetype of young people, right? Is to believe that you're totally free. I was totally inhabiting young person by insisting that I was not responsive to programmed responses or ritualized relationships. And I was irritated when Kyogen would talk about archetypes. He went through a long honeymoon with Joseph Campbell, and we got a lot of the talk of archetypes for a while, and I didn't like it. How could anyone say I was acting out scripts? I was totally fresh. I was totally new, you know? How could anyone say I was just revisiting old stuff? Now, of course, and the older I get, the more I welcome this teaching, the more I welcome the idea that we embody roles and fulfill roles for each other all the time. And not only do I see that this is real, that it really happens, but that they're crucial. These are crucial experiences, that we need these experiences, that all of us has unfinished developmental tasks. Different for all of us. All of us have to take up an archetypal position now and then, because that allows us to complete unfinished work. So what is a parent? When I say the parental role, I mean the guide, the protector, and the disciplinarian. There are a lot of different aspects to the parent. The child is the potential, the innocence, but also ignorance and weakness. So think of times in your life when you've taken that role in response to another person, when you've been the disciplinarian because somebody else is being ignorant. That's what I mean. The teacher is the giver of knowledge, but also the holder and keeper of knowledge, the withholder. And the teacher can also be the whistleblower, the one who's always pointing out the student's flaws. The student, that's the investigator, the seeker, but also the person who's constrained from responsibility, does not get to be responsible. They have to always be in a secondary position. The healer, the giver of health and wholeness, the withholder of secret knowledge, the keeper of secrets. The patient is the wounded one, the needy one, the one that doesn't have to do anything. I've known a lot of patients in my years. The hero saves others, but also sucks up all the attention, gets all the power. And the villain, villains are really interesting, aren't they? The obstacle, the thwarter, but also the destroyer. I once gave Kyogen a little statue of Ganesh, the elephant god, for his birthday, because I had discovered that Ganesh's power was the giver and thwarter of the student. The giver and thwarter of knowledge. And I loved that paired relationship in one person. So most of us are going to inhabit all of these roles at some point in our life in relationship to each other. And we may be in many roles at once. We may be in multiple roles with one person, so that you're like, what are we doing now? And sometimes the roles are going to be in conflict. How many times has somebody been in a healer and a parental role with their family when they themselves got sick? And they can't figure out how to be the patient and still take these other roles, and the family isn't able to let them do that. So our time in each role may be brief, and it may be limited to particular relationships or certain parts of our lives, but you're not going to get to escape these relationships. And I was thinking about how families act out archetypal roles for generations, for many generations. And cultures do too. Cultures promote specific archetypes for specific people in their society and condition members in particular ways. And this can create karma that spills over many generations. People grow up believing rigid and fixed ideas about who they are, who they can be, who they can't be, in part because of the roles they've seen fulfilled. And a lot of what's happening in the early years of our practice is facing up to this. It's learning about what we unconsciously believe about ourselves. It's learning about what is driving our behavior that we're not even aware of, and how we have ideas about how we fit in the world or don't fit. Some people are walking around with that sense of themselves, not exactly as a villain, but as the outlier, as not fitting. So these roles can be they can be suffocating and hard to get out of. Like, you feel, I don't seem to have control over this. But there's positives here. A person who can fully embody the child at some point as an adult, who has a healthy parent person nearby, can really fulfill that potential, can fully fulfill their potential. A person who can truly enter into the student role with a healthy teacher nearby can do a deep investigation of their question. We may be trying to understand intimacy or trust, and there's a lot of ways these pairings can help us to explore intimacy. We may be needing to learn how to express our emotions, or take responsibility, or stop avoiding risk. Each position can teach us something, and in each of these places, we can get really deeply stuck. So for years in our practice, we're just trying to hear that inner dialogue that is driving us. Now, in my early years of practice, I really longed to be in a relationship with Kyogen, but I resisted being a student. That's capital S, student. I realize now that I resisted in part because I was actually capital C child. And I fought that really hard. Being either student or child interfered with a very deep need for independence that I was one of my semi-conscious scripts. Thank you. So I had a very strong need to be self-reliant and independent. I was an adult. I had a family. I had a career. I didn't want to need anyone, but I needed my teacher. And I needed capital T teacher. I longed for that teacher. There's an entire tradition in Vajrayana Buddhism called longing for the guru, and it is expressing this deeply archetypal need for a teacher that is embodied in a person. We don't go quite as far with it as they do in Vajrayana. It can be quite surrendered in Vajrayana, but I felt that very deep need for someone to stand in that position in my life. Plus, I wanted to be different from all these other needy students. Because I liked being different. I liked being independent. And that came in conflict with loving being a student. I loved the trust and the intimacy. I needed to practice trust and intimacy, and I loved learning, but I wanted to already know everything. So that was difficult. And all these reactions and conflicts, of course, are the archetype of student. I was being a student by resisting being a student. Because I resisted with my whole heart. And then I fell into it with my whole heart. And I was in conflict with my whole heart. And that wholeheartedness is part of this. All right, just... So if you find yourself in a role, if you wake up to being in one of these roles, which is how it usually happens, just be there. You may find that you've been cast as the hero in someone's story, or you've been cast as the villain in someone's story. You may suddenly be expected to be the healer for another person's life, or that you have to enter that wholly vulnerable place of the broken one, the wounded one, the patient. And you may wake up to the fact that you've cast yourself as the hero, or the villain, or the teacher. And I want to say that you can, I talk about this in terms of relationship, but you may actually be responding to the world that way. Always being the child, everywhere, wherever you turn. Always being the villain, resisting an obstacle to everything. So I don't think we should concretize this. In the early days of the Zen Center, and I mean a long time ago when we were a much smaller group, there was a lot of teasing and joking about this, joking about how the residents were children, And when the Carlsons were gone, the children, when the cats away, the mice would play. We'd make jokes like that. And it felt like that at times, but I think it was a really shallow understanding of the pretty complex dynamics of what is essentially a family, the residential container. The residential container is a hotbed of archetypal roles, as all small groups can be. There's a Pure Land teacher and psychotherapist named David Brazier. I think that's how you say it, Brazier. And he actually was a Zen monk at Throstle Hole, which is the sister monastery to Shasta Abbey. So he trained in our lineage, although he became a Pure Land teacher eventually. He writes, in psychotherapy, our clients come to us as victims of many stories that battle it out inside them and will not die. We think we are a single unified ego, but experience reveals us to be the victim of many different seductive stories. And then he goes on to do something I think is very interesting, which is to warn us that we also make a cover story out of our practice. We create an archetype of the spiritual practitioner to inhabit. And he says, the idea of being a unified ego, of being a true self, is just another story. I think that's pretty smart. Because in escaping the roles we find ourselves in and the scripts we hear in our head out in the world, we can try to hide in here and pretend there aren't any. By being a good Zen student. So I don't think we should joke about these things. It's pretty... I do joke about them sometimes, but we probably shouldn't too much. Any more than we should act out scripts when we know better, with a wink and a nod. It's very serious stuff. It certainly was serious to me to realize that I was an adult in a very serious course of training, acting like a rebellious child or an insecure child. And it was almost like I could just watch it happen. And then on another day, I would be the mature student, and Kyogen dismisses me like the inattentive father. Very confusing, very hard, very useful, and it was very important practice. When you wake up in an archetypal moment, just own it. I was thinking that we shouldn't let it act out. Let it act yourself out. Let it act you. See what happens. Now, of course, we're here to do much more than heal our psychological lives. I'm wary of getting into the psychology stuff because we are here to find the ground of being. We are here for that bottomless sea of Buddha nature, for that ocean of being, right? That true and infinite freedom of no self. Being with everything, that's what we're here for. But our psychological lives can be in the way, so understanding them is important. My friend Barry Magid is a Zen teacher in New York, and his career has been as a psychoanalysts on the Upper East Side of New York City. And he says they suffer too. Should not assume there's no suffering on the Upper East Side. He wrote a wonderful book called Ordinary Mind about how to do this paired work. He says, too often, it seems that both students and teachers have mastered their physical pain but succumbed to their impulses, experienced a oneness with all beings but remained in conflict with their family, discovered the emptiness of self but abused their authority. In short, found peace on their cushions but not in their lives. So we can approach an awakened life through disciplined practice and meditation and study, but we can't get there. We can't have that awakened life without clearing up some of the obscurations of our smaller self. We have to work our way through some of these scripts running in our head. These images of the self, these layers of who we are supposed to be that are laid on our mind, on our clear mind. They're just overlaid. So to shift gears just to deepen this into that practice, there's an ancient Buddhist teaching called exchanging self and other. It's part of what is called the four social laws, or the four methods of guidance, or the four ways of leading sentient beings to enlightenment. And the Buddha says in the Lotus Sutra that this is one of the many wonderful teachings he got from his cousin Devadatta in a past life. The four social laws are giving, kind speech, beneficial action, and identity action. And they're considered upaya, a method for awakening, but also treated as virtues in and of themselves, natural qualities of an enlightened being. And I want to talk about identity action, which has always interested me because it's subtle, it's tricky. The Sanskrit word is samana artata, and it's translated in a lot of interesting ways. Cooperation, identity of purpose, identification of self with others, non-difference, mutual service, non-opposition, cooperative function. So some of those translations talk about becoming one with another, and some of them are talking about working together with others. And I think it contains both of those things. Dogen devotes a fascicle to this, A Bodhisattva's Methods for Social Relations, Bodhisatta Shishoho. And he particularly focuses on identity action. And this is a quote from Dogen. Identity action means not to be different, neither different from self nor from others. Neither from self or others. What does that mean? It is how in the human world the Tathagata identifies with human beings. Action means form, dignity, and attitude. After letting others identify with ourself, there may be a principle of letting ourself identify with others. Guanxi says, "The ocean does not refuse water. Therefore, it is able to achieve vastness. Mountains do not refuse earth. Therefore, they are able to become tall." We should know in ourselves that because the ocean does not refuse to be the ocean, it can be the ocean and achieve greatness. Because mountains do not refuse to be mountains, they can be mountains and reach great heights. Identity action is the practice and vow of a bodhisattva. We should simply face all beings with a gentle expression. Most of the time, our relationships don't feel quite as easy as ocean and water. So we practice with this. We test the boundaries of self and other. We test how close we can get to another, to taking another's position. And with archetypes, that often, it's what I think of as the karma dance. Oh, we're going this way now? Oh, is that what we're doing? Instead of fighting this relationship we find ourselves in, it's moving with it, moving into it, constantly noticing, oh, is this what we're doing? Oh, am I the child now? Oh, am I the teacher now? Am I your lover now? Am I your mother now? We move together without resistance. That's the karma dance, without resistance. And we meet each other liberated within the limits that we have. We have limits as human beings, and we can be liberated within our limits. For me specifically, the experience of having been in a particularly clear way eventually, both child and student, in relationship to a healthy person, opened me up to the seeds of Dharma within myself. It allowed me to become my own parent. It allowed me to become my own teacher. It enabled me to discover the archetypal parts that were already there that I didn't have access to. And finally, I just want to note that the Buddha says with great gratitude that he received this teaching from Devadatta in a past life. In Devadatta's life, he became intensely jealous of the Buddha's success and tried to kill him. Practice never stops. In the Buddha's lifetime, Devadatta was the villain. But in the lifetime before that, he'd been the teacher. So.
Thank you, Jiko. We will now have questions and comments. If you're in the Zendo, please raise your hand and I'll bring the microphone to you. Please also state your name. If you're on Zoom, you can type your question or comment in the chat box and it will be read aloud, or you can type your name and you will be unmuted. Thank you.
Satan Kakumio has a comment.
Hi, I'm Sasha. This talk really resonated with me, especially right now. I've been kind of having some struggles with parental relationships, specifically, like, literally with my parents, and one of them being stuck in a child archetype, and me feeling like I'm not receiving that parent that I would like to have because they're so stuck in that child state. And I feel myself starting to try to create a parental role for myself, but I'm also still a child. So it's like those two roles are butting heads a lot. And I don't really know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we all get to go through that one to some extent, right? And I'd encourage you to maybe look for a parental role that's outside the family. Look for a person, a healthy person. It's always going to have to be someone who's got some sense of themselves, who can hold some of that for you to take some of that pressure off. It's also part of the child role to grow up and fight back. And whether we're 50 years old or 15, part of getting out of the child role is to take some responsibility for your life. Parents and children are very complicated, and it can happen quietly or it can happen violently, but there will be separation. So accept that that's part of the role that you're in. Is the separating. And it's good that you accept that you're not all the way there. Because we are all,
yes.
We're all still growing up.
Thank you.
Kakumio here. I think we often, like one of the ways we tend to talk about identity action here is like being in harmony with the situation. And that quote by Guanxi, it really struck me. There's this wooden statue of Kanzan in Japan that I've never seen personally, but I've seen pictures of, and every time I see it, it just has such a immense impact. Like it's so symbolic for me somehow. It's just like something is kind of tapped in there, and something about that quote about the mountains not minding the earth, and the oceans not minding the water, like. It has that same resonance to it, and I just wanted to appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, this is Genko. A couple of things reminded me of an experience I had where, as many of you know, I was a caregiver for my partner who went through advanced breast cancer for 9 years. And about 3 years into it, so I was a caregiver and she was the patient, perhaps, I guess you would say, in some ways. Obviously, there were more facets to our relationship than that, but that was a prominent part of it. And about 3 years in, I suddenly had a cancer scare as well and surgery. And for that period of time between trying to figure out what's going on here, diagnosis, surgery, and recovery, we switched roles. Now, that was really weird. You know, it was sort of like, wait, you're not supposed to be sitting there. You're supposed to be up here on the table. So that was interesting. And one of the things we discovered about it is that we did those, both of those roles, in different ways. Mm-hmm. So we called them the mother and the queen, which was kind of fun. But I guess the point I wanted to make here was that, you know, we get into a role and we think the role is defining us. But we can also define the role to some extent. Mm-hmm. And it can teach us some things. So it was like we discovered things about ourselves by switching that way. Completely unintentional, obviously. But, you know, these things happen as you say. It's like all of a sudden there you are in a different role.
Yeah, and it could happen right now, happen tomorrow. Sometimes we need a warm and fuzzy, lovey nurse. And sometimes we need a tough, disciplined nurse, and you know, we don't always know what we need. I think that's part of the interesting thing about these roles is, you know, you fight what you're receiving from another person. It may actually be what you need the most, and that's what the fight is coming from, is that resistance to becoming that.
So, like, she would define caregiving as cleaning the house and especially the floors. I didn't care about the floors. So, but it made me realize she's probably been feeling kind of like neglected in all this time because I don't...
She wished you were cleaning the floor.
Yes.
She was expressing...
So it can be something that's you know, that small, some kind of a detail like that. It's just very interesting.
You know, the other aspect of this is that when an emergency comes up, we find depths in ourselves that we had no idea were there. All of a sudden, the weak child, the ignorant child, suddenly can just step up and become the parent because it has to happen right now. And learn from that. It's quite instructive.
Yeah.
That we have huge worlds inside ourselves.
We have depths of courage we don't know until we have to have them.
Right.
And then, oh, look at that. Yeah. Pretty cool.
There's Daicho behind you, Satan. All the way back. Oh, sorry. I didn't see you. I couldn't see you. I'm sorry.
Thank you. I'm Lindsay. Yeah, no, I wanted to thank you for your talk. It really, it's like a lot of ideas I think about, but different words to put to them, which was really beautiful. And I just thought about how, for me, I feel like this role of like child has been like, just being like a young cisgendered woman is like projected on you really heavy throughout my life, and it's, for me, it's, I'm in the first time in my life in my professional world where I've been able to be like more of a healer and teacher, and that's like been so incredible, you know, and healing to me. And I realize like, oh, I have so much just like you were saying, that resistance to being the student, the child, and that means something about me. You know, and I think though almost all of us have like so many wounds from being children, and how hard that is. And when I think about that quote, that'd be like mountains don't resist the sky and all that. Yeah, I don't know if I have just a question or more just a comment, but letting yourself be that child is so vulnerable,
right.
You know, it's
right.
So scary.
That's the child is one place we learn trust. And we may have our trust violated and learn how to recover from that. I mean, there's a lot of lessons there. But I was thinking about how, Kakume was talking about being in harmony with, and I was saying we dance together. Mm-hmm. Sometimes what we do is we choose not to. So every time a person comes at you as a child, you just don't take that role. You respond as an adult, respond as a teacher. And eventually, it takes some of the heat out of that. We're each of us responsible for what we're putting into that relationship. So, depends on what you need. Yeah. I saw some other hands, so there's Daicho back there, and then Sage.
Hi, this is Mikio, and so archetypes, I haven't thought about it for a while, but when I was listening to you, I just thought, oftentimes what I'm conscious of is archetypes of guest and host. And so it's a little different from parent and child, and also from teacher and student. To me, there's an assumption that, okay, we don't really know each other, but I will be a host, or I will be, you know, graciously your guest. And so I wonder if you have some words about this particular type of relationship.
Well, that's really interesting, because we also use guest and host in a different way in Zen, as we just did in our liturgy. That host is free of archetypes. That host is just liberated, a liberated state of being with the world. We don't mean, you're not talking about that kind of guest and host. You're talking about the sort of stranger that needs hospitality and providing the hospitality. And that's especially in the business world and the service world, you're in that, in and out of that all the time. Having to constantly, the host has to put themselves second and take care of the guest's needs. And the guest has to not be unreasonable about that. So we can be a bad guest, and we can be a poor host. So that's a good pairing. Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sage is over here, so.
This is Sage. I was pretty much born into adult role. Some of my earliest memories are figuring out which ingredients you can eat without putting things together, figuring out how to open a can, figuring out how to use a microwave, figuring out how to survive. And I stayed in that role my whole life. There was never a point where I relax into that child role or have anyone care for me. Until recently, like a few years ago, I finally put my own life kind of together and was like, okay, now this is a sort of comfortable spot. I'm going to sit and sort of go back to this child mind and see what that's like. And so I've been really playful and just like kind of goofy and hanging out in this child mind, child archetype. I really like it. I associate student much with that too. I really love being in a student role, but when I think to other archetypes, or when I find myself in the position of another archetype, I'm just like terrified, like to my core. I'm like shaking right now. I don't know. Like I feel like I don't have any agency in this. I feel like then I was that archetype, and now I'm this archetype, and I don't.
Do you understand that that's a child's response?
No, I did not.
It's terrifying to be a child sometimes. The world is so mysterious and big and scary and dangerous. So it's part of what you're experiencing now is what it's like to not know what to do next. What it's like to not have any idea what to do. So lean on the parents and the teachers in your life to help you experience this. You're doing it with open eyes, so that's great.
Thank you.
This is Satan here. I'm curious to hear more about what you would say to how one moves out of specific archetypal roles that they have placed themselves in. Because some of those roles that we place ourselves in, I think, can be pretty isolating.
Yeah, I mean, they limit the kind of exchange you can have with another person. So they're very useful in that you're going to practice that particular exchange, but that's all you're going to get to do, right? In most of our relationships, we're in and out of all of this all the time, with more or less control. But there's always going to be a few things. I mean, I always have tended to take on the parental role. And it has to do with my childhood, and it's all, you know, painfully obvious and all of that. But I had to do a lot of work to see that and to understand why, and then consciously try to put it down. Like, really, just consciously discipline myself to shut up and to not guide and to not protect a person who's capable of doing that. Which changes the dance steps. And that's one reason it's hard to put it down, because the other person is putting you back into it. So it's a conscious effort of both awareness and a change of how you respond. It's not going to feel particularly like something you can pick up, put down for a long time. We're aware of it for a long time before we can do much about it, if that makes sense. But that awareness, I mean, that's cutting the roots right there. You have cut the roots of the karma. It will eventually fade as soon as you see it. You know the image of wisteria, kato. It's a very complicated image in Zen, but it's an image of very long, big wisteria vines. And if you cut the roots, it blooms for at least another season. Because the message takes a long time to get up to that flower. Mm-hmm. So we cut the roots of our karma, but the flowers will go on for a while. So just keep doing the work.
Thank you.
I think maybe one more at the most, if there's no more. Nope.
Hi, I'm Kayin. I'm hearing, like, kind of, I think, two different, like, responses to this. And I hear that, like, there's pros and cons to each side, but, like, I don't know, I'm feeling some confusion. You've talked about, like, not filling the script, and you've also talked about, like, I don't know exactly the words, so like leaving space for that archetype. And like I'm confused about like what fits when. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's all about looking up and seeing what's going on. Sometimes we don't have a choice. We're just dancing a particular dance with another person, but we can know that. We can see that that's happening. And that, by that I mean, it's not the whole world. It's not filling our minds. We see that it takes place in a context, even if we can't stop it. Even if it's the same fight we've had before, we're fighting it again, we at least know that that's what it is. There are other times when we may be free enough to say, you know what? I want to do this differently. Let's try doing this differently. But it's all about those eyes open, okay? And realizing that what's happening right now is just a little local weather phenomenon in a very big universe.
So to clarify, the ideal is that these aren't roles that we're in.
The ideal is that you know what you're doing and you're choosing.
I knew that was a trap of a question.
The ideal is freedom to pick and choose, to pick up and put down. We have the phrase in Zen of changing faces, switching heads and changing faces. Like literally, I'm going to take my mother hat off. I'm going to put on my sister hat because now I'm visiting my sister. I'm going to change the face and go to work. But I know that that's what I'm doing. And I know that none of them are the true me. And none of them are the whole me. Does it make sense? Okay.
Thank you.